Only thing is, the places you asked Sophie to check, the bed frame and the jacuzzi, they're too clean. No prints, just smudges. Sophie says our guy could have wiped the place down. Ah, score. Steve does a fist pump. No reason why Rory would be wiping down the bed frame when that was his first time in the house. Yeah, you're a genius. Or Aisling could have just been a clean freak. Sophie says it plays either way. Steve still looks pleased with himself. Anything else? You mean that says Aisling's other fellow was real? Yeah. Not so far. No sign of him on Facebook, not on her mobile, not on her email. A junkie has cornered two lost-looking backpacker types and is hassling them for cash. I snap my fingers in his face and point off down the road without bothering to break stride or find my ID, and he takes one look at us and bobbles off obediently. If he exists. They must have made their appointments by ESP. Or Aisling deleted all their messages, Steve points out. Or he did. I've only started cross-checking the phone records and I'm still waiting on the emails. Couple of interesting things on the laptop though, I say. Don't get too overexcited. But Aisling read up on a couple of gang cases. Francie Hannan and the guy with the tongue. Steve's face has whipped round to me. They were Cue Ball Lanigan's boys, both of them. I feel him get caught up by the same roller coaster surge that's speeding me along the footpath. Feel the buzzing of the thing in our minds build higher. And they were both Breslin's cases. If he ended up in Lanigan's pocket, right, and if Aisling was seeing one of the gang and it went wrong, the first thing Lanigan would do... I told you not to get overexcited. I've put out feelers. If Aisling was seeing someone from Lanigan's crew, I'll know soon enough. Steve looks a little wounded that I'm not opening up, but he'll have to live with that. The other good thing on our laptop, there's a password-protected folder of pictures that she created in September. It's labelled mortgage. Steve laughs out loud, and I can't help a grin. Yeah, that's obviously bullshit. Sophie and her lot are still trying to crack the password. She'll keep us updated. Did she tell Breslin about it? Nah, neither did I, and I'm not planning to. Steve says, so since September, Aisling's been worried about someone going through her laptop. That's not Rory. She only met him in December, and he'd never been over to her place before. Maybe, I say. Or else the folder's full of naked selfies. And Aisling wasn't worried about anyone specific. She just didn't want some junkie robbing our laptop and uploading our full frontals. Naked selfies? For who? For kicks. For little extra income. Left over from one of the exes. For some day when she's old and wrinkly and wants to remember what a babe she was. How would I know? Or, Steve says, it's photos of her with her secret fella. And she really, really didn't want anyone, including him, knowing she had them. Yet, anyway. I've been thinking the same thing. Blackmail. Or insurance. If she was with a gangster, maybe she had just enough sense to know this could turn dangerous. If, I say. From now on, every time you say if about this case, you owe me a quid. I'll be rich by the weekend. I thought you liked a challenge, Steve says, grinning.
Admit it. You hope I'm right.
I do, yeah. That'd make a nice change.
You do.
We've slowed down behind a pair of gabbing old ones, I say. I'd only love this to come true. I've been trying not to say it out loud because I don't want to jinx it. Like a dumb kid. Like one of those moaners who believe the universe has it in for them and everything is just looking for an excuse to turn to shite. I've never been that. This is new. It's stupid. It comes from the squad training me to look for booby traps everywhere. Last week I left my coffee in the squad room while I went for a piss. Came back and nearly had it to my mouth before I saw the floating gob of spit. And no way in hell am I going to blab it to Steve. I don't fucking like being what anyone trains me to be. I don't like it at all. I keep walking and count tall guys in dark overcoats. Steve says, But nothing. I don't want to get too attached to the idea till we've got some actual evidence is all. He starts to say something, but I'm done with that. And here's the other thing, I say, dodging around the old ones and picking up the pace again. Remember I said I had a word with Breslin about ringing Sophie? Oh, Jesus. Will he live? Oh, yeah. His makeup will cover the bruises. You were nice to him, right? Oh, tell me you were nice to him. Relax the cacks, I say. Everything's grand. That's the interesting part. I wasn't nice to him. I was busting his balls on purpose. But he just kept on being nice to me. So maybe he wasn't bullshitting us last night. Steve is trying on the idea for size and stretching hard to make it fit. Maybe he genuinely does think we're all right. You think? I called him a cheeky little bollocks who was getting above himself, and I said, while he's on my investigation, he needs to do what I tell him. Steve lets out a snort of horrified laughter. Yeah, well, I wanted to see what he would do. I expected him to take me head off. But you know what he did? He sighed and said, okay, grand, from now on, he'll run things past me. Steve has stopped laughing. I say, does that sound like Breslin to you? After a moment, he says, it sounds like Breslin really wants to stay on speaking terms with us. Like, badly? Exactly. And that's so he can keep track of what we're at. It's not because he's got faith in us to turn into lovely little team players, or whatever it was. When I found him, right, he was having a chat with McCann, and they shut up sharp when they saw me. Breslin gave me some crap about McCann's marriage problems, but I'm pretty sure they were discussing the quickest way to get rid of me. Steve shoots me a look I can't read. You figure, what did they say? I lift one shoulder. I didn't give enough of a shit to memorise it. McCann wasn't happy. Breslin was reassuring him that he'd have some woman sorted in no time and everything would go back to normal. McCann wanted him to hurry it up. That was the gist of it. And you're positive it couldn't actually have been about McCann's wife? It could have been, but it wasn't. Some wanker with a logo jacket and a clipboard bounds up to us, opens his mouth, takes a second look and backs off. I'm getting my mojo back. 2 days ago, he would probably have followed me down the street, badgering me for money to end third world psoriasis and telling me to smile. Okay, Steve says. We've been wondering if Breslin could be bent. Even this far from the job, both of us automatically glance over our shoulders. What if it's McCann? I didn't even think of that. For a second I feel like a fool, letting paranoia distract me from the real stuff. But that blows away on the rising rush of excitement, that bad dare growing bigger. That could work. I'm skimming through what I know about McCann. From Drogheda. A wife and 4 teenage kids. Not from money. Not like Breslin. I remember him saying something sour once about cutting the crime rate to zero by making all the spoiled brats with their smartphones go into apprenticeships at 14, the way his dad did. No bank of mum and dad to fall back on if the car dies. The house needs re-roofing, the kids need college fees, and Adi's salary isn't cutting it. A A gang boss looking for a pet would like McCann a lot. Or both of them. No wonder Breslin took everything you could dish out, Steve says. He can't afford to have us telling the gaffer we want rid of him. If, I say, if any of this is real. If, Steve says. How did you leave things with Breslin? I apologised. Told him I was too intimidated by his awesomeness to think straight. Well, you like that. You think he believed you? I shrug. I don't really care. If he didn't, he just thinks I'm an archy bitch, and he thought that anyway. He was looking for an excuse to be buddies with me again. I gave him one. We're good. We're at the carpool, just in that short walk. I've spotted 11 tall guys in dark overcoats. Everyone made me feel more like a paranoid idiot. But the whole bunch of them can't scrub away the prickle of warning when I think of the guy at the top of my road. Steve says in the gateway, what do we do? What we need to do, just for starters, is pull Breslin's and McCann's financials, pull their phone records, and have someone turn their computers inside out to find out if they've been accessing anything they shouldn't be. None of which is going to happen. Keep working our case, keep talking to them, keep our mouths shut. I wave to the guy who runs the carpool. He waves back and turns to look for the cadet's keys. And I'm going to see if I can make Breslin eat a bug. Aisling's gaff has been processed hard. When there's someone coming home to a place, we try not to wreck it too badly. Print dust gets wiped away. Books go back on shelves, unless we actually want to shake people up. But when no one's coming home, we don't bother breaking out the sensitivity. Sophie's lot covered half the house in black print dust and the other half in white. Carved away a rough rectangle of carpet where Aisling's body was lying. Sawed a long chunk out of the fireplace around. Stripped the bed and sliced gaping holes out of the mattress. In a cosy, messy family home, that stuff looks nightmarish, against nature, but Aisling's house barely looked like a real person's gaff to start with. Now, it looks like a tech bureau teaching unit. Steve takes the sitting room and the bathroom. I have the kitchen and the bedroom. It's quiet. Steve whistles to himself, and the odd sound trickles in from the street outside. A bunch of old ones happily bitching their way past. A kid howling. But not a squeak or a bump out of the neighbours. These old walls are thick. Unless there was a blazing row or a scream, there's no way the neighbours would have heard anything. A stealth boyfriend, one who'd been to her place before, he would have known that. The search gives me nothing relevant. Your standard hiding places, packet of peas in the freezer, emptied out canister in the spice rack, under the mattress, inside shoes, are blank. No love notes in the curly-whirly dressing table. No spare pair of morning after boxers in the chest of drawers. In the wardrobe, no envelope of cash or package of brown waiting to be picked up. The best I come up with is a bunch of family photo albums shoved to the back of the top shelf behind the spare duvet. I take a look, see if they give me any hints on where I saw Aisling before. But no. She wasn't a good-looking kid. Chunky, with skinned back plaits, a bumpy forehead, and an uncomfortable smile. For someone who put this much gym time and celery and hair products into looking the way Aisling looked, that will be plenty of reason to hide the albums. There's no family pics up around the gaff either. Pukey fabric prints of flowers and gingham chickens go on our walls. But our family goes at the back of the wardrobe. A shrink would love that. Aisling wanted to bury her parents as revenge for abandoning her. Or she had to bury her real self so she could reinvent herself as Dream Date Barbie. But all I care about is that no one else in any of the photos looks familiar. Wherever I saw Aisling, our gaff isn't going to give me any hints. The weird part is that I'm turning up nothing irrelevant either. The search always has a surprise or two for you, because everyone's got a couple of things they hide, even from their nearest and dearest. The only question is whether the surprises have anything to do with the case. But there's nothing here that Lucy didn't give us. In fact, since I found zero evidence of any secret boyfriend, there's actually less here than Lucy gave us. No dodgy internet diet pills, no niche sex toys. I haven't even found that copy of the rules. The biggest revelation is that Aisling sometimes wore padded bras. Her paperwork's in shite shape, Steve says, in the bedroom doorway. Everything's thrown together in a big box under the side table. Bank statements, bills, receipts, the lot. I shove the albums back on the wardrobe shelf. Gaffney's pulling the financials. We'll go through them that way. Bring back the box anyway. We need to check the receipts, in case the guy who delivered the sofa got a fixation. Anything interesting? Her will. DIY job on a form printed off the internet. She left half of everything to Lucy, the other half to provide respite for child carers. Who knows if it'll stand up to probate. Lucky for Lucy, she's got an alibi. Yeah, Steve says. It's dated 2 months ago.
So maybe Aisling was starting to worry that she was over her head in something dodgy.
Or maybe she just figured it was time she got all grown up and had a will. Anything else? She had a first-time passport application form filled in. Photo and all, ready to go. So, she wanted a sun holiday, don't we all? Steve says. Or she knew she might have to get out of the country sometime soon. Maybe. I slammed the wardrobe door. Well, that's it. No escort appointment book. No wad of cash inside the sofa. No guy deodorant in the bathroom cabinet. He shakes his head. You? Fuck all. We look at each other across the pretty daisy-patterned carpet and the slashed bed. Well, Steve says, after a moment, maybe the pubs will give us something. We come away with the box of paperwork to dump in the back of the cadet before we canvass the pubs, and not a lot else. Me and Steve give good search, but I feel like Aisling snuck something right past us, and no matter how many times I think back, I can't figure out what or where it could be. I underestimated barmen and Aisling, and possibly overestimated her bit on the side. The first few pubs we try, Steve gets blank looks and head shakes, while I hold up my notebook all ready to take non-existent notes and give him the told-you-so eyebrow. But the barman in Ganley's, a back-alley dive, ratty enough that it's managed to avoid the hipsters looking for authenticity and hang on to its clientele of huddled old fellas in saggy jackets, takes one look at the photo and taps Aisling's face.
Yeah, she was in.
You positive it was her? Steve asks, throwing me a triumphant look. The barman is maybe 70, baldy and bright-eyed, with shiny armbands on his starched shirt.
Ah, yeah. She ordered a peach snaps and cranberry. Said she was trying out all the mad drinks she could think of. See what she liked best. I told her if she was looking for excitement, she was in the wrong place. She settled for rum and ginger ale.
He tilts the photo to the light, what there is of it.
Yeah, it was her all right. I had a good old stare for myself. Have to take my chances where I can. We don't get the likes of her in here all that often.
Am I not good looking enough for you, no?
Demands an owfella on a bar stool.
You can look all you like. I won't charge you. The state of you. That's why I was staring at that young one. I need something to clear the sight of you out of my head.
When was she in? Steve asks. The barman considers.
A few months back. August, maybe. On her own? Ah, no. I wouldn't like her. I wouldn't say she does spend much time on her own.
The old lad on the bar stool lets out an appreciative cackle. The barman says,
she was with a fella.
That gets me another ha look from Steve.
Do you remember what he looked like?
Oh, I wasn't concentrating on him, if you know what I mean. He was older than her. I remember that. 40s, maybe 50. Nothing special. Not fat or skinny or nothing. Tallish, maybe. He had all his hair. Anyway, fair play to him.
Which fits well enough with the guy climbing Aisling's wall. I think it before I can help it. Fits the guy hanging around at the top of my road, too. Steve says, would you recognise him if you saw him again? The barman shrugs.
I might, or I might not. I won't promise you anything.
I ask, would you say he was her fella? Any holding hands? Any kissing? Or could he have been just a friend? An uncle? Something like that? The barman makes a face and wavers his head.
Could have gone either way. No canoodling, nothing like that. But I remember thinking they were sitting awful close if they weren't a couple. And that she could have done better for herself.
Like you, what?
The old lad wants to know.
Yeah, what's wrong with me? I've still got me figure.
Maybe he was a millionaire, Steve says.
Did he look flush?
Not that I noticed. Like I said, nothing special.
What would a millionaire be doing in a kip like this?
The old lad demands.
Looking for a proper pint,
the barman says with dignity.
If he'd have found one, he'd have come back.
Has he been? Steve asks.
No. Only saw either of them the once.
I say, what about me? Have I been in before? The barman narrows his eyes up at me and grins.
You have, yeah. Summer before last, was it? With a load of other ones and fellas, sitting over in that corner having a laugh.
Fair play, I say. I stand out a lot more than Aisling, but it's been longer since I was in. The barman isn't talking shite to make us happy. He remembers her.
What do I win?
Read that, and if it's all correct, sign at the bottom, I say, holding out my notebook.
If you're lucky, you win the chance to come into the station and tell us the same thing on tape.
The old lad is craning his neck to get a look at Aisling's photo. He says,
is she in hassle, yeah? She after doing something on someone?
Leave it, Freddy,
the barman says, without looking up from my notebook.
I don't want to know.
He signs his name with a trim tap of the pen at the end, passes the notebook back to me, and picks up his glass cloth.
Anything else, no?
Outside, Steve slides the photo of Aisling back into his jacket pocket. He's thinking, I told you so, loud enough that he doesn't need to bother coming out with it.
So?
He says instead.
So?
I say. The thought of the incident room left to its own devices, or Breslin's, is making me antsy.
That's all the locals. Can we get back to the squad now, yeah?
Yeah, no problem. We head back down the potholed laneway towards the road. That rain is kicking in. Nasty, spitty flecks edging towards sleet. I hope Mean was brisk enough to get done in time. A bubble of low-grade trouble is building up on the corner. Kids who can't go home because they're mitching off school. But apart from them, the street's empty. A marker graffiti creature, all bared teeth and bug eyes, stares us out of it from the shutter on an abandoned shop. between a missing cat poster and some leftover summer fair thing. Dancing kites and ice creams grinning manically from their faded paper. Steve's self-control runs out. The secret boyfriend's looking good. He is, I say. Or else that was some guy from Aisling's work. She worked way out in Clondalkin. Why would they go for pints in Stoneybatter unless they were buzzing off each other and didn't want to get spotted? Or a pal from her wine tasting class, or whatever she was at in August? The car is parked half a dozen pubs back. I pick up the pace. Those fancy clubs she liked? Those are full of good-looking, rich, young guys. Aisling could have had any of them. Why would she be buzzing off some middle-aged fella who was nothing special? Steve shrugs. There's women who prefer older guys. Rory's her same age, give or take. She could have had a daddy complex before. Remember what Lucy said? Aisling's dad leaving, that messed up her life. Maybe she went looking for a father figure. When that didn't turn out the way she was hoping, she switched to guys her own. Jesus. I nearly walk into a lamppost, slam a hand against it at the last second. That's where I knew her from. That's where I fucking saw her. What? Where? Jesus Christ. My palm is throbbing. The glossy paint of the lamppost feels slimy against it. I can hear the street corner kids laughing at me somewhere behind us. Her. Missing persons, 2.5 years back. I was on the front desk one lunchtime, a sunny day near the end of my time on the squad. The breeze floating in through the open window smelled like country air, like the summer had thrown off all the layers of city to come cartwheeling in clean and sweet. I was listening to bouncy 90s pop trailing out of a sunroof, eating a turkey sandwich, thinking about that morning's happy ending. 10-year-old disappeared after a fight with his parents. We found him playing Nintendo in his best mate's bedroom, and about murder waiting for me just a couple of weeks away. It felt like we were on the same side that day, me and the world. It felt good. When the girl in the crap suit hovered in the doorway, I put the sandwich away and gave her just the right smile and, "Can I help you?" Not pushy, just warm and encouraging. It worked. She dumped her whole story on my desk. Her dad, such a lovely, sweet, wonderful man. How he taught her to play chess, and he took her to Paris Court Waterfall in his taxi, and he could make her giggle till she got the hiccups. The day she came downstairs in her school uniform, and her mother was frantically ringing her dad's mobile for the 100th time. He never got home last night. I can't find him. Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I know he's dead. The detectives who took statements and made reassuring noises about how most missing people come home within a few days just need a bit of time to themselves. The few days turning into weeks and still no sign of Super Daddy. The detectives' visits getting farther apart and their reassuring noises getting vaguer. The one who finally patted her on the head and said, "You have great memories of him. We don't want to change that, do we? Sometimes these things are better left as they are." That has to mean he knew something. Don't you think it? Or at least he had an idea. Even just an idea. Doesn't it sound like that to you? Like he knew what... Her, leaning in across my desk, fingers woven together so tight the knuckles were white. Me, shrugging blank-faced. I wouldn't be able to speculate on the detective's thought process. Sorry. So she kept going. The weeks turning into months, into years. Jumping a mile every time the phone rang. spending every birthday waiting for the postman to bring a card. The nights listening to her mother crying on and on. The times she was sure she spotted him walking down the street, nearly lapped out of her skin before the guy turned his head and was some randomer, and she was left gasping and paralysed, watching the one moment she wanted from the world dissolve to dust and blow away. One look at my face should have told her this was getting her nowhere. But she kept on going. You get that in missing persons. People who think seeing their faces, hearing them cry, will make you do your job better. You get parents who come in every year on the anniversary of the day their kid disappeared to find out if you have even one new scrap of info. It sort of works. You keep track of the anniversary, put in a few extra hours when it's coming up, do your damnedest to find something to give them. This chick was a whole other story. I had zero intention of busting my arse trying to help her find Daddy, which is what I told her, in a slightly more tactful way. Wondering how hard I would have to blank her before she would fuck off out of my face. Files can't be released. Freedom of Information Act doesn't apply to police investigations. Sorry, can't help you. And of course, then she whipped out the tears. Please, couldn't you just look up the file? You can't imagine what it's like growing up without yada, yada, yada. And some Hollywood-style puke about needing to know the truth so it couldn't control her life anymore. Now, I can't swear she actually used the words closure and empowered, because I'd stopped listening, but they would have fit right in. By that stage, my happy buzz was well and truly wrecked. All I wanted was to shut the bitch up and kick her out the door. Aisling wasn't looking for a daddy substitute. She was looking for daddy. I say, Aisling's dad didn't just walk out on them. He went missing. She came into missing persons looking for info. I was on the desk. Huh? Steve says, thinking that over. Just gone, Lucy said. Remember, I never copped that meant missing. What did you give Aisling? I gave her fuck all. She was whinging at me. Could I not look up the file and tell her what was in there, pretty please? I feel it all over again. The rush of anger rising up from my gut and flaring under my ribs. I shoved myself away from the lamppost and start walking. I gave her the name of one of the older guys who would have been on the squad back then, told her to come back on his shift, pointed her at the door. Steve has to lengthen his stride to keep up with me. Did she? Come back? I didn't ask. Didn't give a shite. Did you have a look at our dad's file? No, I didn't. What part of didn't give a shite isn't getting through to you? Steve ignores the bite in my voice. He dodges a yapping clump of Uggs and buggies and says, I'd love to see that file. That gets my attention. You think there's a link? Her dad going missing or getting killed? I think that's a lot of bad shite to happen to one family just by coincidence. I've seen worse. I'm not sure I want this case to turn out interesting. Not anymore. If we're thinking about the gangster boyfriend thing, it feels like the whole of Stony Batter is yammering at me. We won't pay. Spray painted on a patched garage door. Women laughing hysterically about butter from a bus shelter ad. An old one from my street waving at me across the road. I wave back and speed up before she heads over for a chat. We've got no evidence the gangster boyfriend ever existed. Remember? You made him up. Yeah, but if... Go with it for a second. I'll owe you the quid. I don't laugh. Whatever. Say Aisling thought some gang was involved in disappearing our dad. And say she didn't get any satisfaction out of missing persons. Steve's being tactful. He means, say, some bitch gave her the brush off. Why the hell would you think that? She didn't say anything about gangs to me. She was all about how perfect Daddy was. She'd have lost the plot if I'd suggested he ever had a parking ticket. And the gang boys don't waste their time disappearing normal, decent citizens. Maybe she didn't know that. We know she was naive. Maybe she thought gangs were like the villains in stories, going around looking to grab people just out of badness. Or maybe she found out the dad wasn't as much of a saint as she thought. There are normal, decent citizens who get mixed up with gangs. I say reluctantly, I think he was a taxi driver. The gang lads love getting taxi drivers on side. All their own cars are on watch lists, under surveillance half the time, occasionally bugged. A taxi man can ferry drugs, guns, money, people, all under the radar. There you go, Steve says triumphantly, on it like a puppy on a treat. He gets tangled up with the bad boys, puts a foot wrong, ends up in the mountains with two on the back of the head. Missing persons can't prove it, but they know the story. And when Aisling talks to your mate, he lets something slip. She decides to do a bit of her own investigating. Before she knows it, she's in way over her head. Her bookshelf, I say. I'd rather keep my mouth shut and hope this whole bloody thing will go away. But I suppose Steve's earned his extra treat. Book on missing persons. Right next to the one on Irish gangland crime. Both of them full of underlining. He practically bounces. See? See what I mean? Doing our own investigating. Fuck this might have crap, I say, pulling out my phone. This is one of the ways I know. No matter what the shipboards and murder try to gaslight me into thinking. I'm not just some ball-breaking, humourless bitch that no normal person could work with. I got on grand in missing persons. I didn't make any buzzing buddies, but I had a few laughs, few pints. I was in on a medium disgusting running joke involving one of the lads in a squeaky rubber hamster. And I can still ring up anyone I need to. The guy I sent her to was Gary O'Rourke. I'm going to ask him. Gary's phone rings out to voicemail. Gary, how ya? It's Antoinette. I'm going to owe you a pint. I need a favour. I'm looking for a guy who went missing somewhere around 1998 or 97, give or take. So it might not be in the computer. Make it 2 points. Guy called Desmond Murray. Address in Greystones, taxi driver, age anywhere between, say, 30 and 50. Probably reported by his wife. You might remember the daughter, Aisling. She came in looking for info a couple of years back. I need whatever you've got. Send it over to me ASAP. And can you tell your guy to make sure he gives this stuff directly to me or my partner, Maureen? Yeah? Thanks. I hang up. 10 minutes ago, I was enjoying this case. I liked that. Made a nice change. And now, just like that whiny voice warned me, it's finding a way to turn to shite. The brainless fucking bitch, I say. Steve's eyes widen. Say what? You know something? If I ditch this gig, I'm going to set up as a therapist. A new kind. Especially for people like Aisling. For 100 quid an hour, I clatter you across the back of the head and tell you to cop yourself on. Because she might have got herself mixed up with a gang. I don't give a shite about that. If it even happened, which you still haven't convinced me. I'm crossing the road fast enough that he has to jog a step or two to keep up. A car whips past inches from our arses. No, because she was 26 years old and chasing after Daddy. Whining for him to fix everything for her. That's fucking pathetic. Come on, Steve says, catching up on the footpath. This isn't some spoiled daddy's girl, ringing him to change her flat tire. Aisling's dad leaving pretty much to find our life, not in a good way. We don't know what she went through. We can't. I bleeding do know. My dad split before I was even born,
Do I look to you like I'm mooning about, dreaming up ways to find him and throw myself into his arms? Which shuts Steve up. It shuts me up too. I didn't know that was gonna come out of my mouth till I heard it. After a moment, he says, I didn't realise. You never said. I never said because it doesn't matter. That's my point. He's gone. Gone means irrelevant. End of story. Steve says, carefully. He knows he could get hurt here. Are you telling me you never thought about him? Seriously? I say, I did, yeah. I thought about him a lot. There should be a special word for that level of understatement. When I was little, I thought about him all the time. I wrote him a letter every week, telling him how great I was. How I'd got all my maths homework right and beaten everyone in the class at sprinting. So that when I finally found an address to send them to, he would realise I was worth coming back for. I walked out of school every day looking for his white limo to scoop me up and speed me away from the bare concrete yard and the aggro-eyed kids with their places already booked in rehab and prison. Away to somewhere blue and green and blazing where wonderful lives lay in glittering heaps waiting for me to choose. Every night I lay in bed imagining them. Me with scrubs and a stethoscope in a hospital so blinding with white and chrome it looked ready to lift off. Me going down a sweep of staircase to an orchestra waltz in a dress made of spin and foam. Me riding horseback along a beach, eating fancy fruit in a morning courtyard, shooting orders from a leather office chair 40 stories above my dizzy view. I thought the exact same as Ashley. When he came back, that's when my real life would start. Steve, God help us, is trying to find the right level of compassionate, I say. Jesus, face on you. Don't be giving me the big sad eyes, you sap. I was like 8. And then I grew up and copped myself on. And I realised this is my real life. And I'd bleeding well better start running it myself instead of waiting for someone else to do the job for me. That's what grown-ups do. And now, you don't think about him anymore? Haven't thought about him in years. I mostly forget he existed. And that's what Ashlyn would have done if she had the brains of a fucking M&M. Her ma too. Steve moves his head non-committally. It's not the same thing. You never knew your father. Ashlyn's dad was someone she loved. Probably has a point, sort of, but I don't care. He's someone who was gone. Ashlyn and her ma, they could have got on with life. Figured they'd deal with the answers when and if they got any. Instead, they decided to make their whole lives all about someone who wasn't even there. I don't care who he was. That's pathetic. Maybe. Fucking pathetic, I say. End of story. Steve doesn't answer. We keep walking. Up ahead, I can see the car right where we left it, which is nice. I want Steve to talk. I'm feeling for any difference in him. The distance he keeps from me, the angle of his head, the tone of his voice. The reason I don't tell people about my father, apart from the fact that it's none of their business, is that they hear the story and move me in their minds, either to the box marked, ah, poor pet, or to the box marked, scanger. Steve grew up a lot like I did. Probably he was a little posher, lived in a council house instead of a council flat, and had a dad with a job, and a ma who put those lace things on the back of the sofa. But he would have been in school with plenty of kids who didn't know their daddies. I'm not worried about him getting snobby on me. But Steve is a romantic. He likes his stories artistic, with loads of high drama, a predictable pattern, and a pretty finish with all the loose ends tied up. I wouldn't put it past him to imagine me as the tragic abandoned child fighting her way through her demons to a better life. And if he does, I'm going to have to smack him across the head. He's not throwing me gooey looks, at least, or walking closer to support me through my pain. All I can tell, out of the corner of my eye, is that he's thinking hard. After a while, he says, "What if she found him? What are you on about?" The relief makes me sound snotty. "The secret guy Aisling kept ditching Lucy for. The guy in the pub." Steve goes round to his side of the car and leans on the roof while I dig for my keys. What if it wasn't a boyfriend after all? What if it was our dad? She tracks him down. They're trying to rebuild their relationship. Ah, Jesus, that does it. I want to floor it all the way to Rory Fallon's gaff and arrest the hell out of him before it can turn out that Aisling was having a heartwarming reunion rendezvous with Daddy and I have to listen to all the syrupy details. That's £4 you owe me. No, when Steve grins. I am going to lose my bleeding mind if I have to put up with this if shite any longer. I don't even want to think about Aisling's dad until Gary rings back and gives us the actual story. Meanwhile, you're not getting into this car till you give me me £4. I jingle the keys and stare him out of it till he reaches into his pocket and shoves a fiver across the roof of the car. "Where's me change?" he demands when I pocket the fiver and unlock the doors. "By the time we get back to HQ, you'll owe it to me anyway. Get in." "Okay," Steve says, swinging himself into the car. "Might as well use it up now." So, if the dad wants to make up for years of not being there to protect Aisling, and he doesn't like the cut of Rory, "Sweet fuck," I say, starting the cadet and listening to a bitch about being woken up. "What if I pay you not to do this shite? Would that work?"
"You should definitely give it a go. I take checks."
"Do you take Snickers bars? Because at least you shut your gob when you're eating."
"Ah, lovely," Steve says happily. "I'll be good."
I find the Snickers bar in my satchel and toss it into his lap, and he settles down to demolish it. He doesn't look like he's thinking about what an inspiration I am, or what a tragic story. I know Steve is nowhere near the simple, freckled-faced kid he plays on TV. But still, he looks like he's thinking about chocolate.
"What?"
he demands, through a mouthful. "Nothing," I say. "The bit of silence suits you, is all." And I catch myself grinning as I swing the car into the flow of traffic.
Chapter 8. We get back to an incident room full of nothing. Breslin is still out, presumably talking to Rory's KAs. The floaters come in and out, fetching more nothing and dumping it on our big fancy desk. Staunton and Deasy turned up nothing at Aisling's work. No rumours of an affair with the boss or anyone else. No unrequited crushes either way. No office feuds. No stalkery clients. Mean comes back from checking Rory's route home to report that his times matched the CCTV footage, meaning Rory didn't take any major detours between Aisling's house and the last time he was caught on camera. Although we've got no way of confirming what time he got home or what he did afterwards, so we can't rule out a last-minute detour or a late-night excursion. Gaffney is running Aisling's KAs through the system, which spits out a load of traffic tickets, a couple of minor drug possession charges, and one guy who smashed his brother's windscreen with a Hoover. Riley slouches in with more CCTV footage and a flat stare at me, settles down to watch some telly, and occasionally lets out a noise halfway between a cough and a roar to remind us that he's here and he's bored. I'm itching to look up Cueball Lanigan's boys on the system, but I'm not going to do it. I feel like a twat taking the gang thing that seriously,
Plus, the search will be logged for anyone to find. Just like we found the search someone ran on Aisling last autumn. Instead, I go through the statements from the door to door again. Properly, this time. Looking for the little things that need following up. I'm not finding them. Daphne went to town with a highlighter pen on one woman's statement that she heard the guy in number 15 roaring about killing someone a week or two back. But seeing as number 15 has three teenagers, I figure we don't need to break out the waterboarding equipment just yet. Steve cross-checks Aisling's phone records against her phone and comes up with no discrepancies. No one's been deleting texts or call logs. Not Aisling and not our guy. No calls or texts from unidentified numbers either. Every number is in her contacts list. And we'll track down the contacts to make sure they are who the phone says they are. Or else comes back to some customer service department. That has its good side. It's a nice punch in the face for Steve's cute little fantasy about an Aisling and Daddy reunion. But I'd give a lot for just one text from an unregistered mobile saying, "Meet me for a shag by the heroin stash at 8. Every investigation nets you plenty of nothing. You need that. It's the only way you can narrow down your focus. And normally it feels good. Slashing the dead ends off your whiteboard. Leaving the live stuff to leap out at you big and bold. This time though, there's no slashing going on. Just little bits of useless nothing splatting onto my desk like spitballs from some joker I can't catch. That soaring buzz is turning to edginess, making me shift and knee jiggle and rub away imaginary itches against the back of my chair. I need something, anything that'll zap away Steve's great big fluffy cloud of if-based babble and leave me with the stuff solid enough to stand on. Incident room C looks empty to the point of ridiculous. The half dozen of us dotted around a room that would take 30 easily. The high ceiling and the shining rows of desks shrinking us to dollhouse size. I'm starting to wonder if Brezen was taking the piss out of us. Getting the luxury suite for a 2 cent case that would have fit in that ex-locker room shithole with space left over. At 2 o'clock, we send Gaffney out for pizza. And Staunton pulls up one of the Saab radio shows on his phone for lunchtime light relief. Sure enough, they've got a big segment about Aisling, leading into a general outrage fest about how the country is getting more dangerous for decent, law-abiding citizens and the guards don't give a damn, complete with phone-ins from old ones who are mugged and left to die in pools of their own blood, while uniforms stepped over them looking for a politician's hole to lick. They even have Crowley on, being profound about how our cavalier attitude towards Aisling's murder and our oppressive bullying of geniuses like himself are both symbolic of the sickness of our society on an almost mythic level. Whatever he thinks that means. For a minute there, while we all crease ourselves laughing, we forget what we think of each other. "My cousin went out with him for a while," Mean says.
"Your cousin's got shy taste,"
Riley tells him.
"She does, yeah. She dumped him because he wouldn't wear johnnies. He said they were a feminist conspiracy to suppress masculine energy."
Everyone cracks up again.
"Fucking beautiful," Staunton says, reaching to grab another slice. "I'm going to see if I can get away with that."
"Not a chance," I say. "If even someone thick enough to shag Crowley didn't fall for it. No offence to your cousin, Mean."
"Nah, ya grand. She is thick. She lent the little bollocks 3 grand so he could self-publish his autobiography."
That sets everyone off again.
"Never got a penny of it back." "What do you call it?" Kelleher says. "Johnny, I hardly knew ye. Free Willy," I say.
That gets a laugh, with a startled edge. Like half the floaters didn't think I was able for it.
"Here we go," Steve says,
swiping at his phone. Truth's Martyr by Louis Crowley.
No, listen. There's a review. 5 stars. A searing, towering dissection of one man's odyssey to reveal the hidden shadows of Irish justice. If you care at all about truth, Jesus, it's longer than the book.
Anyone want to put money on who wrote that? Staunton says.
How do you reveal a hidden shadow?
Kelleher wants to know.
You lot are just part of the conspiracy, Mean tells us all. I bet you go around trying to put Johnnies on poor unsuspecting fellas on the street.
Riley beckons to him.
Come here till I stick one on you. It'd take 3 of yours.
Here, Staunton says, throwing a greasy paper napkin at Mean.
Suppress your masculine energy with that.
Mean slaps the napkin away and it goes into Kelleher's coffee. And all of them start telling me that I need to write up the rest for harassment and creating a hostile workplace environment and wearing crap ties and farting in the unmarked cars. For that minute, the incident room feels like a good place.
I'm sure many guards are fine people, Crowley tells us from Staunton's phone.
But when one of them practically assaults me, simply because I want to keep you informed on what they're doing about this beautiful young woman's death, then I think we all have to ask ourselves why she, or he of course, is so desperate to control what we're allowed to hear. After all, underneath the solemn voice, he's obviously creaming his chinos with delight. His story is taking on a life of its own, parallel to reality and getting a lot more traction. Riley is grinning.
That'll do, I say. The laugh has worn off.
Crowley is giving me the sick. Yous aren't a shower of school kids. Get some work done. Staunton switches off the radio and they all turn back to their computers, throwing each other sideways glances and eyebrow lifts about what a bitch I am, and the incident room goes back to normal. The only bit of actual something that comes in is the pathologist's report. Cooper hates most people, but he likes me. Probably out of pure contrariness, but you take what you can get. So he rings me when he finishes writing up the postmortem, instead of making me wait for his report.
Detective Conway, he says. I was sorry to miss you at the crime scene yesterday, which is my cue to apologise for not making it in time.
We were sorry to miss you, I say, snapping my fingers at Steve to get his attention. We got caught up in roadworks. I appreciate you ringing me, Dr. Cooper. The pleasure is mine. I trust the investigation is progressing well.
Not too bad. We've got a good suspect. I could do with a bit more hard evidence and a bit less if then maybe.
Steve makes a face at me.
Any chance you can help me out there? I think I can promise you a minimum of if then maybe, Cooper says with delicate disdain, like I used bad language. It is hardly my stock in trade.
That'll be a nice change, I say, making a face right back at Steve. Cooper makes a small crunchy noise that could be a laugh.
As far as hard evidence goes, the vast majority of the post-mortem examination provided no unexpected information. The victim was in good health, showed no signs of injuries received prior to Saturday night, had not had recent sexual intercourse, was not pregnant, and had never borne a child.
Cooper takes a pause and clears his throat. With that out of the way, we're getting to the good stuff.
As I suggested at the scene, she suffered 2 sets of injuries, one to the face and one to the back of the skull. The pattern of the facial injuries is consistent with a punch. The salient fact about this punch is the degree of damage it inflicted. The victim's jawbone was fractured
and two of her lower left incisors were broken, almost out of their sockets. Considerable force was required. I think we can safely say that the blow was inflicted by a man of above average strength and fitness.
I mouth, "Strong guy," at Steve. He raises his eyebrows at me. "That sound like Rory to you?"
"Those injuries, however," Cooper says, "would not have been life-threatening. The fatal injury was to the right rear of the skull. This injury is linear, approximately 2.5 inches long, and made by an object with a sharp right-angled edge, consistent with the fireplace surround on which the victim was found. The blow caused a severe skull fracture, leading to an extradural hematoma. In the absence of immediate medical attention, the increasing pressure on the brain resulted in death. The victim took the punch, went over backwards and hit her head on the fireplace surround," I say. "How long would it have taken her to die?" "Impossible to say. An extradural hematoma can cause death within minutes or within hours. Given the severity of the injury, I would have expected this one to progress fairly rapidly. Precisely how rapidly, however, there is no way to know. One possible indicator, however, may lie in the second injury to the right rear of the skull."
"Whoa," I say.
"Second injury." Steve's eyebrows go up. I kick my chair closer to him, switch on speakerphone, and put a finger to my lips. Cooper hasn't made up his mind about Steve yet. One wrong word out of him could end the conversation right there. I feel a weird, idiotic twitch of triumph, like the bad kid seeing her golden little brother in the doghouse while she gets the pats on the head for once. I slap it down.
"Restrain your excitement, detective," Cooper says. "This second injury is minor, a slight contusion. Apart from that, it is practically identical to the first. Linear, 2 inches long, made by an object with a right-angled edge. The two injuries are parallel, lying approximately 1/4 inch apart, which explains why the second was not immediately obvious at the scene."
He sounds miffed at the thing for hiding out in him.
I say, "So after the victim went down, either she lifted her head and then dropped it again, or else the killer did."
"Hmm," Cooper says. Steve is scribbling something in his notebook.
"Either is possible.
The killer could certainly have lifted her head to check for signs of life, or she could have attempted to get up but been unable to do more than raise her head. I would expect the initial injury to cause unconsciousness. There was some intraparenchymal bleeding, which generally has immediate neurological consequences, but it is plausible that she briefly regained consciousness before death."
Steve passes me his notebook. Steve is about the only cop I know who has legible writing. Nice writing, full of definite, old-fashioned loops and dashes. I think he practices in his spare time. The page says, "Or, first a push, then the punch when she's down." I ask, "Could the injuries have come the other way around? The killer initially pushed our victim rather than punching her. She went over backwards, hit her head in the fireplace, but not hard. Then when she was down and stunned, he went after her and punched her in the face."
"Ah," Cooper says, enjoying that. "Aha, interesting. And possible, certainly possible. Impressive, Detective Conway."
"That's why they pay me the big bucks," I say.
Steve mouths, "Hey," and points at his chest. I turn up my pen and grin at him. "Nothing I can do, man. Hate that."
"Hmm,"
Cooper says, and I hear pages flicking.
"In light of this new theory, I must revise my estimate of the killer's strength. If The punch occurred when the victim's head was already lying on the stones around, rather than when she was freestanding, so to speak. It would have required considerably less force to inflict these injuries. Some strength would still be needed, but any healthy adult of normal muscular development could have done it. I'm giving Steve the eyebrows right back. That does sound like Rory Fallon. Sorry to make you rewrite your report, I say. Cooper handwrites. None of us have the nads to invite him into the 21st century, so we get floaters to type up his reports. I would forgive worse sins for the pleasure of hearing an alternative theory that fits the facts so neatly, Cooper says. The rewritten report will be with you as soon as possible. I wish you the best of luck in finding hard evidence. And he hangs up. Me and Steve look at each other. That's not manslaughter, he says. Nope, not if that's how it went down. People get knocked down all the time, get up and hit back. No one expects that to kill. But if you punch someone in the face while the back of her head is up against a sharp stone edge, it takes some cojones to claim you thought you'd get up and walk away. And Breslin likes it, being manslaughter. His voice has dipped low. He's right. Breslin jumps straight on the manslaughter scenario. Maybe because that's a better fit with Rory Fallon. And Breslin wants this to be Rory, just to make everyone's life simpler. Maybe because he knows well that it isn't, but he thinks we're more likely to bite on the manslaughter story. Yeah, I say. Let's see what he thinks of the murder version. Do you see Rory Fallon doing that? Steve asks. One wild swing, yeah, but going after her like that? Whoever did this was raging, I say. He snapped. We already knew that. And we're not looking for King Kong. Rory could have done it, no problem. Could have. But we still don't have a good reason why he would have snapped. And as far as we can find, he's got no experience with violence. Something as vicious as that punch. It's not easy. Not for someone who hasn't touched another person since he was 9 and gave his brother a dig. It'd come more naturally to someone who was in practice. Nah, nah, nah. I give my chair a shove back to my end of the desk. Even the wheels on the incident room seat chairs work better. You heard, Rory. All the most intense shit in that guy's life goes on inside his head. People like that, you can't go by what you see. We don't know what he's been practicing in there. For all we know, he spent years rolling out a whole alternative life where he's a cage fighter. When the pressure was on, it came popping out and bang. The thought of that punch, bone crunching against stone, flashes through both their heads. Steve is right. It's hard to see Rory on the end of that. But that could be because neither of us wants to. This is why I keep telling you to quit the if crap, I say. Hazardous to your health. Don't worry, Steve says, going back to his paperwork. In my fantasy life, I'm the super detective who never misses a solve. Deadly. Now, all we have to do is get you under enough pressure that he pops out. Steve glances over, and the abrupt, wry snap of the look startles me. For a moment, I think he's going to say something, but then he shakes his head and starts running his pen down a line of phone numbers. Just to be clear, I know, and what with Steve not being a certified moron, I assume he knows too, that we should be on our knees praying Rory Fallon is all there is to this case. If we find any evidence that Breslin is bent, we're in deep shite. If you catch another cop breaking the rules, or the law, or both, your first line option is to keep your mouth shut. This is what practically everyone does about the pissant stuff, like squaring traffic tickets and running private background checks. You look the other way. Because it's not worth the hassle, and because sooner or later, you could be the one who needs someone to blink. But even if we want to go that route, which I'm nowhere near sure I do,
It's not going to be that easy this time. Not if whatever we find is tangled up with our murder case.
Your second option, the one you're supposed to take, is a visit to internal affairs.
I've never tried it. I hear sometimes it gets the job done.
Maybe once in a while, it even gets the job done. Without word getting around and turning you into radioactive waste. And without you spending the rest of your life feeling like a rat.
Your third option is to have a chat with the guy. Tell him he needs to knock it off. For the sake of his conscience, or his career, or his family, or whatever. Maybe this one sometimes works too. I can just see the look on Breslin's face if I go finger wagging at him about what a bold boy he's been. If I don't drown in the spill of self-righteous outrage, I'll spend what's left of my career trying to look over both shoulders at once. Your fourth option is to go to your gaffer, who'll presumably give you wise, fatherly pats on the shoulder, tell you you did the right thing, and do either option two or option three for you. Seeing what my relationship with O'Kelly is like and what his relationship with Breslin is like, I'm going to go ahead and figure that, even if I wanted to go running to Big Daddy for help. This one is off the table. Your fifth option is to drop a couple of hints and get in on the action. Maybe you actually want to join in the fun. Maybe you just want a little off the top of the other guy's kickback in exchange for keeping your mouth shut. I don't like money enough to sell myself for it. And I don't like anything enough to tie my life to some scumbag who's already proven he can't be trusted. Your sixth option is to find yourself a journalist. One who has balls the size of watermelons and doesn't mind being pulled over for drink driving every other day for the rest of his life and go full on whistleblower. None of those sound good to me. I'm loving this chase. Every second of it. I don't give a damn whether that means I'm a bad person. But I know if we actually catch what we're hunting, it's probably going to rip our faces off. I'm having a hard time sitting still. Every few minutes I turn my head to look at Steve, sprawled over his desk like a student, fingers dug into that orange hair, frowning down at his whirlpool of paper. I can't tell what's going on in there. A couple of times I actually have my mouth open to ask him if, what do we do if, every time I end up shutting my mouth again and going back to work. The energy in an incident room usually dips in the middle of the afternoon, same as the energy in any office, but today it stays running high. Partly it's the room, making us all want to prove we're up to its standards, but partly it's me. The mood comes from the top, and that dare is whirling in my mind like a bad boy lover, speeding up my heartbeat every time it bobs to the surface, beckoning and menacing. The wicked grin of it keeps me working flat out, and when I finish fine-tooth combing reports, it keeps me up and moving around the room, adding to the whiteboard, grabbing tip line sheets. Some anonymous guy is positive he's seen Aisling on a very specialised website. Stamping on bugs, which sounds unlikely, but which the lucky people in computer crime will get to investigate anyway. I check out what the floaters are doing, toss out snippets of well done and try this. I can do the managerial shite just fine when I feel like it. I have a laugh with Kelleher, tell Staunton and Deasy how their interviews with Aisling's colleagues were bang on. Breslin would be proud of me. The thought of him. He should be back soon. Sets me circling again. Steve's caught it too. He's on the phone, trying to light a fire under his meteor guy for the full records on that unregistered phone. We could go out, burn off that fizz interviewing witnesses. But I don't want to go anywhere. I don't want to miss Breslin. Gaffney has finished his list of Aisling's evening classes, which, if I wasn't in a good mood, would be depressing as hell. Aisling genuinely paid actual money for a class called Restyle You? With the exclamation mark?
also for one on wine appreciation and something called Busy Babes Boot Camp. And he's ringing round for lists of students. I take the financials off him and go through them for anomalies, while Breslin's not there to look over my shoulder. No unexplained sums of money into or out of Aisling's current account. The only thing that sticks out is that Lucy was right. Aisling had a fair bit of cash. She opened a savings account the same month she started work, back in 2006, and most of her salary went straight in there. In the last couple of years, she